Hey, everybody, I'm Tom. I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a grateful member of Al-Anon, and as you'll hear when I get into the story, I really can't tell one without the other. So I am focusing, as I've been asked to, on the AA experience, but again, they're kind of interwoven in terms of the stories. So I was born in Midland, Texas, a big family. I've got five brothers and one sister. And my family was, I don't think it's that different than any other upbringing. But I think what might have been a little bit different was just the number of kids that we had and the chaos that can come from that when you have, basically a dad that works a lot and is out of the house and a mom that's trying to run a house for seven kids. But the other part that was definitely impacted what happened in our house is that at a pretty young age, when I was pretty young, my mom had a pretty profound religious conversion. She was always Catholic, but she became really, really, really Catholic. And I'm not kidding. She was like a person that went to church once a week, right, for a long time, and then she was a whole other thing. Like, to just give you an example, she as it progressed, as she became more and more convicted about her faith and convinced that she needed to go further into it, she actually was one of those people that would be out on the sidewalk outside an abortion clinic, trying to counsel people from going in. I mean, she would have eventually gone to the point of getting arrested at that because she was so, but my dad at one point said, no, you gotta stop. So she's doing that, and there's a certain just amount of, craziness that goes along with someone who's just going down that road. She became so focused on that there really wasn't anything else in sight. And she's still got, bear in mind, she's raising seven kids while this is going on. And then my dad, who was, a good provider and, a stoic, another World War II vet. I don't know exactly what was going on with my dad, but he always had like a thing going on with one of his secretaries. It wasn't exactly an affair, but it was really something, And then, he had a uniform, is what I like to call it. We moved from Texas to New Mexico, and we ended up in Las Vegas, Nevada. I basically grew up in Nevada. And my dad's uniform was a shirt like this, open. And it's Nevada, it's hot, and Las Vegas especially. And he wore Speedo, not a bathing suit, briefs, right? And flip-flops. I'm talking always. Like, that's what he wore. Like, not work. He didn't go to work that way. We got off work. That's just what he said. And so, I was reluctant to bring friends over to the house. Because I wanted him to meet my dad, but I didn't want him to meet my dad that way. So that's going on. So he's got my dad, who's whatever's going on. I don't know what's going on over here. But then my mom, who's got this real religious thing going, and nobody's talking about it. Nobody's going to talk about it because it doesn't really exist. And so everybody's kind of choosing in my family what to do around that, And some people got way off into drugs and alcohol, and some people acted out. I had a little brother that. 2 years younger than me, he was doing hard drugs, alcohol, acid, by the time he was like 12 years old, And initially my reaction was to just be as good as I could be. I'm an athlete, I'm gonna doing good in school. Now, while I'm doing that, I also, just because of the environment I'm in, and my family, I also got into drugs and alcohol. I started to drink when I was exposed to my first drink when I was probably 10 or 11, beer on a trip we had. And then I just fell in with what my family did. And the reason it was hard for me to identify myself as an alcoholic for a long time or a drug addict is I did drugs the way everybody around me did, but not nearly as much as some of my brothers. And I always compared myself to them. And I compared myself to the people around me, and we were all doing drugs. We were all drinking. So it just seemed so normal. So it took me a long time to actually kind of really figure out that I was an alcoholic. But so I got out of, so another thing that happened, just one other dynamic I think influenced all of what happened to me, my codependency, my alcoholism, was that while all this was going on, we had this big family, and I talked about my brother that's 2 years younger than me. Well, he really started acting out. He got in trouble. He was kind of a bully at school. He didn't do well, and a lot of focus was on him. And then my youngest brother, I was worried about him because my father, while this is all going on, my father got a job at the Nevada test site. And he drove to work, 90 miles to work every day. 90 miles, so it's 90 miles one way, 90 miles the other way. And so he just disappeared. He was so tired by the time he got home from work. And his one thing he'd say is, you know, he'd basically say, I don't want to hear one more thing. You know, so he'd lay the law down when he got home. It's like, you know, that's what he'd do when he walk in the door. I don't want to hear one more thing. You know, just, I want quiet, you know. So he had been, like, involved before that. Little League coaching and all kinds of things, and he just was gone. And so I thought, I'll step up, man. And basically, I took care of my younger brother, and that's where I learned a lot of my codependency. I was like, he's got to have somebody to drive him to his soccer games, and he's got to have somebody that shows up and talks to the coach if they need to talk, and even, like, teachers. I mean, I was basically his surrogate parent, and I loved it because I love my brother, and something I could do is, like, I can do this. You know, that was the thing. I've got this. That was my like, mantra. I can take care of this, right? And got out of high school, went to college. I did pretty well in college, you know, okay. Definitely my drinking started ramping up. What I did in college that I think is a little different than other people is that I would study really hard, study, 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 study. And I actually became a residential advisor, lived in the dorms so I could, you know, help me with you know, my financial situation while I was in college. And so, like, I had to be in the dorm, and I couldn't, like, drink or do drugs while I'm RA because I have to, you know, clear out the building if there's a fire or something, you know. But when I wasn't on duty and after my tests were all done, I would just go on this binge. You know, I would drink as much as I could drink. I'd smoke as much pot as I could smoke. It would just be ridiculous. And a lot of times I'd get sick because I would be study, 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 stay up, don't get sleep, and then just go on this binge, and I'd get just really sick, you know. I did that several times through college. I was like, I don't think that's really normal, you know. But for me, it was my system. It was like the thing I did. Like, I'm going to study really hard for this exam, and my reward is I'm going to get just obliterated, right? And that's what I did. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic. Because everybody around me was doing a little bit more, and my brother was getting in more trouble. I was getting because as I was doing this, I was getting the decent grades. I went to, I got out of school and I worked for a while, and I went to grad school, and I ended up finding a career that I liked quite a bit. I ended up getting involved in playing music. I found a band I really liked to play in, and we were making money and having a good time, and everything was kind of going along. And while that's going on. My alcoholism and drug abuse is just ramping up, and it's real gradual. It's just like it's a slowly ramping up thing. My tolerance is increasing, but I'm not having a lot of consequences around it. You know, my life is kind of working. And I end up in this job where it's a lot more responsibility. I have... like 4 managers that work for me and about 100 plus employees, and it's a lot of stress. And I remember this, I would joke about it with people. I'd say, I don't know, you know, these people say that alcohol doesn't help with stress. It really does. Like, because I would get off work and I'd be stressed out and I'd have 3 or 4 glasses of wine. I'm not stressed anymore. I'm feeling good, you know? And that worked for a while, you know? I mean, I'm sure it didn't work as well as I thought it worked, you know? Like, I think I was probably a lot more charming in my head than I really was. All that stuff that alcoholics do, right? But it worked in the sense that outwardly things were holding together. And then I met somebody. While I was still working that job, it was really stressful. And I had this girlfriend that I'd been with for 5 years, and she was really, really good to me. And but there was something about, and I was kind of getting ready to actually propose to marry her, but I couldn't do it. And I met this other gal that worked for me, actually. She worked a couple clicks down. And it really wasn't ethical for me to date this gal. It just really wasn't. And I had all these justifications for why it was okay. And we ended up getting involved. And the way I justified it, I was getting ready to leave this job. And I was taking basically starting a business. But it really wasn't right for me to do it. But I got involved with her. And it was like, I don't know how to describe it. We were both really going on our way to become alcoholics, and we were going fast, you know. And we met each other, and she was, you know, really exciting and really fun and pretty crazy, you know. And so was I, actually. I was getting to the point where alcohol was, you know, becoming a bigger factor for me. So we... it was pretty tumultuous relationship. There really, it was probably, I had all kinds of warning signs not to probably move forward. But I got this, at that time I got a job offer. I was living in Reno, Nevada at the time. I got a job offer up in Oregon, back with this program I used to work with. And it was one of these big jobs again, where I'd be managing people. And her and I decided, we made our decision to go and do that, take that job, and to move together to Oregon. We barely knew each other, right? We're moving together to Oregon from Nevada, leaving our families and homes. We did it over like two pitchers of beer. That's we right? And at the end of that, I'm like, I'm trying to figure this out. Okay, this is how we'll do it. And at the end of it, yeah, it sounds perfect, you know. And that also was a pattern over after that, you know, this cycle of drinking a whole bunch, and then her and I just figuring out the whole world, how we're going to do it, how it's going to be, and then, you know, passing out and feeling shitty the next day, walking and waking up trying it again. You know, that was a cycle. The other recurring thing we did is we'd go out to dinner, so we moved to Oregon, basically. We moved to Oregon together. I took this job that was really I didn't want to take. I'd left a pretty nice gig running my own business and had a lot of autonomy. I went back to this really hard job where I was really managing a lot of people. There was a lot of turmoil at this place. There was union stuff going on, and I was management, and it was tough. And so I leaned in farther to what was had been my friend. You know, alcohol, there was always pot going on. I always smoked pot. In Oregon, I found out that you could get mushrooms really easily, psilocybin mushrooms. It was especially when they were in season. So I had this constant thing of mushrooms. I'd have this mushroom tea going on my stove, and I'd just be this, and the weekends especially, it'd be this like, you know, afternoon, you start drinking, smoking cigarettes, smoking pot, mushroom tea, and it's just like riding the wave, you know, the whole weekend. You know? And the part that, so you know, while this is going on, though, there's these things that are getting planted in terms of being incongruent in my life, you know, and I'm not stupid, you know, so I'm paying attention to them. And one of these inconsistencies was one of my roles at this place I worked. It was a big vocational training program for young adults, and I was basically, it would be like the assistant principal, and I actually lived on campus. And I had a house on campus. And one of my roles in the organization was, and so these kids lived on campus, and the thing is we had a lot of rules about you couldn't really drink alcohol on campus, you couldn't do drugs, you couldn't get in fights, all these rules, right? These kids would, there's 540 of them, so every weekend a handful of them would be in trouble. They'd have done something wrong, and someone would have found out, and they'd written up reports, and these reports would come to my group, and I had this little group, and I was judge, jury, and executioner, basically. I decided if these kids stayed or go in the program. And I was really good at kicking them out. Basically, usually my decision was, you go, right? So the thing that was so ridiculous about this is that I was kicking these kids out for getting busted for smoking pot and drinking, and I was a block away all weekend just getting wasted. You know, that's what I was doing. And I'd never, in my... You know, my mind, it was, you know, increasingly affected by the drugs and alcohol. So I never thought it was hypocritical. I was staff. They were students, you know. It was completely hypocritical, you know. And I don't think my judgment was even good Monday morning, because, I mean, Monday morning I had been doing this all weekend, right? And I'd probably still, you know, anyway, but that's what was going on. And it did kind of, I did know in the back of my head there's something wrong here, but I wasn't ready to look at it, you know. And the relationship was not getting any better. We were living now away from our support systems. We were fighting like cats and dogs. I'd gone into this depression from the weather, because I moved from one of the driest places in the country to Astoria, Oregon. and the first winter I lived there, I don't think I make this up. I think it rained 120 inches. And I was like, oh my God, I'm in hell. Like, I don't know what happened. But so, and I'm getting depressed, and I'm working this job, it's tough, and we're fighting, and you know, but the thing is, what am I going to do about this relationship that's so hard? Well, I doubled down. I married her. We got married. Right? I've got this. Right? And, you know, my favorite part, one of my favorite parts of the big book is in Bill's story. He talks about all the drinking he did. I never drank that, I mean, the same way Bill did. I drank a lot. But, you know, there's that line that gradually things got worse, right? And that's what happened. They got worse. And it was ridiculous. We had this, I don't want to go into everything that happened in the story, but it was bad. And I somehow, in the midst of all this, I got a job opportunity here in Seattle. And that's a miracle right there, because I was not at my best in terms of my job performance at the time, right? And I got a job opportunity, a great job opportunity in Seattle. So we moved up to Seattle and got kind of integrated into the community a little bit. Liked the job, but, you know, but we brought our problems with us. The geographic did not change the fact that we were two people that fought a lot and didn't really communicate and drank every night together. And so New Year's Eve, the year we got here, which was 2000, we went out, and this is a pretty normal night by then for us. We went out, had dinner, each of us, we had two bottles of wine at dinner. We go out to a bar after that and drink, I don't know how many drinks at a bar. I'm driving all the while this is happening, right? I'm driving. So, and then we, and on the way home, after drinking, you know, and it's got to be 2 o'clock in the morning by now, she wants to stop at a 7-Eleven and get some more, you know. And at that point, you know, this is where my Al-Anon story starts here. I'm thinking, man, we've been drinking all night. She wants more. She's got a problem. She's got, right? And so we stop and get some booze, beer, whatever. We get home. I don't know what time it is. It's late, you know, it's New Year's, you know, right? And at one point, you know, we're doing the thing we do, we're smoking cigarettes, we're drinking, and I said, I gotta go to bed. And she says, what do you mean we got to go to bed? You know, this is New Year's, let's keep going. I said, no, I really got to go to bed. And she says, well, you're an old man. I was 10 years older than her. She called me an old man. And I said, something I'd never said before, and I said, well, you're a drunk. And that did not go over well. I didn't know. she didn't immediately react. So what happened is, it'd been a long night, and I was, you know, we'd been drinking and smoking. So I got in the shower. I took a shower before I went to bed. I'm taking a shower, and I just kind of see out of the corner of my eye, the shower curtain come over, and this like 6-inch boot she's wearing comes through and kicks me in the shower. And I go slamming into the wall, and I fall down, and then I get out of the shower, put a towel around me, and I go at her, it's the first time I ever hit my wife, right? So this is what was going on, you know, and I'm just crazy, and she's screaming, and I put my clothes on, and I take off in the car. So I, you know, I've been drinking all night, roaring through West Seattle in this car, it's and I'm down on California Avenue, West Seattle, and you know, and now it's 3:30 in the morning on New Year's Eve, right? So anybody that's out at that time, there's something going on, right? And there's these guys that are like beating somebody up on the street, and I'm so crazy. I've been driving around, and I get out of the car, and I go, "Hey!" I'm yelling at these guys, right? And they look at me, and they like stop what they're doing. Like I did save somebody from getting beat up that night, because they like, "This guy's crazy. We're not gonna mess with this guy." Anyway, I get back in my car, I go home, I get to sleep that night, and then I wake up the next day, and I've got pain. I've got like, I don't know what's going on, but I've got pain here, and she's really concerned, and I'm saying, I got pain, I don't know, my arm and my chest. So she calls the paramedics. And so that's New Year's Day, and I don't know, it's 10 o'clock in the morning or whatever, and these paramedics roll up to the house we have in West Seattle, and I don't know if you've seen the paramedics in Seattle, but at the time anyway, they're beautiful people. Like these guys are like 20, 25 years old. They're just ripped. They got muscles. They're tan. I mean, it's like, I was like, what is this? Is this some sort of like a video shoot? Or it's like a... And you know, and they take my shirt off, right? And I'm sitting there, and I'm watching my wife react around these guys. I'm going, shit, you know, these... And they're doing everything they do. They're hooking me up to all this stuff, right? And I can see this mirror in my house, and I see myself, and I really look at myself, and I am pasty. I am 30 pounds overweight. I look like I've been up the whole night. The reason they probably came to me is I think I had a bruising from where she kicked me the night before. But I thought I was having a heart attack, right? And these guys are working on me, and I'm looking at me, and I'm looking at them, and I'm thinking, this is what I'm thinking. I don't know if I got this. Like, I don't. There could be something really wrong. Like, and I had never. I mean, I thought that, but I was like, no. I think there's something wrong. Like, there's really something wrong with my life. Like, I mean, it sounds funny, but I had not really gotten there before. Like, it's like tragically wrong. Like what happened? Like, it was some sort of a thing for a turnaround for me in terms of just the start of like this. I don't know exactly what's going on, but it's got to be something other than this. This is not what, you know, and it was that look in the mirror. I'll never forget it. It's like, God damn. And I had heard about Al-Anon, you know, and I decided to ask around about it. And that was when I decided I wanted to go to Al-Anon because she had a problem. You know, that's the thing. It was really clear that she had a problem. And so I went to my first Al-Anon meeting in West Seattle, and unfortunately, it was a really bad meeting. I didn't know that there's all kinds of different Al-Anon meetings. It was my first one, and it was it's like seven or eight women and two other guys who weren't sharing. The women were all talking about how awful their marriages were and what a bunch of shitheads they lived with and how bad it was. And I went through this thing, and I was like, oh, no. This is Al-Anon, okay. What's next? I walk out in the parking lot and these two guys come over and talk to me, and one of them says, "Hey, you know, that's not exactly representative of what Al-Anon is. You should come to this meeting, West Seattle. Where's Joe? West Seattle, Saturday morning. Come to this meeting." They said it's kind of like a family. It's kind of like a big family, and it's really good. And I went to that, started going to that meeting, and one of the guys that talked to me became my first sponsor. And I stay in touch with him to say he was my Al-Anon sponsor. We started working the steps, and this is where I said I had to talk about Al-Anon a little bit. The first time I came to this retreat, I was in Al-Anon. I wasn't in AA yet. And my sponsor and I did the third step out there, you know, out here. We did the third step together. And during that year, things did get a little better in terms of I'm starting to get some hope around that things can be different and that things can change. But, you know, the meeting was, 8:30 in the morning on Saturday? And Friday nights were big, right, in my house. So, I probably smelled when I got in there, even when after taking a shower, because I drank a lot by then. You know, I was drinking a lot. My wife did decide she was going to try to get in recovery, and the first thing she tried was this, somebody talked about it last night. It was called something, No, not Chick Shale. It was called, Moderation Management. Moderation Management. So she's doing Moderation Management. And she took home the stuff from it, and she said, you know, we should probably run your chart too, you know, just to see, right? and they do it on your weight and your whatever, you know, weight and sex and whatever. And she ran it, and I remember this. I think I remember it pretty accurately. It was something like, for me, I could drink and stay within the things of this program, Moderation Management, like 23 drinks a week. I think it was, as long as you didn't do that, you're cool. And I thought, okay, that's doable. You know, I can do that, right? And I tracked it for a while. Some weeks, I could actually stay under that. Because I was a daily, I drank every day. I drank two or three every night. Sometimes that's all I'd do. I'd have just, and I could go out sometimes and have a couple beers, and I'd stop there. But then there's other times, and I was running this chart for a while, there's other times when the first day I started the chart, starting from like in the afternoon until I quit 2 o'clock the next morning, I would have 22, 23 drinks. I could do that by then. And the only reason I knew that is I was keeping this chart, you know? So it was another seed that got planted. So you can drink 22, 23 drinks from, this would be from like 2 o'clock in the afternoon till 2 o'clock in the morning. But still, that's quite a few drinks, right? And I hadn't realized that. I had never counted them. Just don't count. You just go out all night, you're drinking, you don't count, right? So that's another little seed. And I remember talking to my brother, my younger brother, who's not an alcoholic, about it. And he said, Tom, that's kind of a lot. I was like, really? You know? And so all these little seeds are planted. But so anyway, that year, I'm going Al-Anon, and I'm still married, and we're fighting just as much as we were. I mean, the definition of insanity was it was that we would go out to dinner, and I would know we're gonna have two bottles of wine, and we're gonna get in a fight before the dinner's over, and she's gonna walk out, and I'm gonna be paying the check, and knowing that it's going on a credit card that we're not paying, you know, that debt's going up. And that we're gonna do this tomorrow night. And I knew that, and that's what happened. It was like Groundhog Day, and so that's what life was like. And you know, gradually things got worse. And by the end of that, towards the end of that year, we had this just really awful anniversary. By now we're living in separate places. We're trying to hold it together, but we're living in separate places. And this guy who had been my Al-Anon sponsor, his name's Paul. I'm going to him and I'm going, she's gotta get a job and she's gotta quit drinking. And he's just laughing. He's just going, you know, we're gonna do the steps. We're working on the steps. You're gonna get around. And but I'm telling it. I'm also saying it. And maybe I can find a therapist for us. You know, and he and this is where, to this day, I don't know if he just did this because he knew. I don't know if, but he said, yeah, I know a therapist. I'll find it. I have a therapist. You should probably talk to this therapist. So I go to this therapist, and I tell her all about my wife and how much trouble she's in and the problems she's having. And I also tell her, but somehow I was also honest enough to tell her about decisions that I'd made, and that those decisions had been made also when I was drinking. I told her that. And she and all about how I was in Al-Anon and how great Al-Anon was. And she said, she leaned back in her chair and she says, congratulations. And I said, okay, what? She says, you're a double winner. She knew, because she'd been in a program, she'd been in recovery for 30 years. And this is the part that, to me, that is one of the miracles that's happened since I've been sober and in recovery. I was so miserable when I went in to talk to her. I'd had this miserable time with my wife on our anniversary, trying to make it work. And after fighting with her all night on our anniversary and us drinking and just fighting. We were at Snoqualmie at the falls up there, and I had just thought, I was having these kind of thoughts. What would it be like just to throw yourself over the railing? What would it be like? I'm thinking this. And it's registering that that's too not crazy. I mean, I'm not, or that is crazy. Like all these things are registering. Like I'm thinking about this, right? That's how bad inside I felt. And so, the miracle is that when my Al-Anon sponsor said you should talk to this woman, and I roll in there. If you'd have told me the day before that I was going to walk out of that session with her and be convinced that I needed Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd say you're crazy. But that's what happened. She, in a few minutes, it wasn't even like she had to convince me. She says, you're an alcoholic. She says, I can't help you. She says, I can help you a lot, but only if you do this other thing. Like, I think we can do a lot of work together, but you've got to do this. It's called AA. It's been around a long time. I'm sure you heard of it. That's the thing that you need to do if I'm going to help you. And basically, she put it out that, and I won't help you unless you do that. Like, she was pretty hardcore about it. And I left that session. Called up another guy I knew in Al-Anon, said, do you know where a good AA meeting? And I went to my first AA meeting that Friday night. And that was November 21st, 2001, and I've been sober ever since. Yeah, thanks. I didn't do it perfectly at all, like the first year in terms of AA. I physically felt better right away, like because you know I'd been drinking. It ramped up to the point where I was drinking a lot, and just not drinking and not putting alcohol into my system. Initially, that felt good, and I started doing things like running that I hadn't done in a long time. I just felt physically better. I had a sponsor that I found in West Seattle, but he was a guy that sponsored, he worked at a treatment center, but he sponsored a bunch of people. He didn't really have time to sponsor me, so I'd check in with him once a week. And so I was getting better in the sense that I was feeling better physically, but you know, I had a lot of work to do, obviously. And I went to this retreat again. That would have been my first year of being in recovery, and I'm pretty sure that's when I first got a certain guy's number who's sitting here in this room, phone number. And then I lost it. I lost his number. And I was doing this other Al-Anon thing, and it was like a fifth step workshop in Al-Anon. And when I got this temporary sponsor for that Al-Anon thing, it was a woman who was been in both programs, and she said, oh, okay, you're an AA too. Who's your sponsor? I said, I don't really have a sponsor. She goes, you know, like, what? Like, you're an AA, you've got a few months, you don't have a sponsor? Like, she goes, you got to call this guy. And she gives me Paul's number, same number that I'd lost before. And I said, well, it could be a sign there. Maybe I should call this guy. And I called him up, and he said, yeah, you know, I think we can work together. And then the thing he asked me is, he said, is there anybody who's in your life who's, you know, getting older and might not be in the greatest help, who you're not on good terms with? And I said, yeah. I said, that's my dad. Yeah, we're not on great terms. And he says, okay, well, what we're going to do is you're going to do the steps, but for that, we're going to fast track. We're basically going to go through the steps so you can make an amends to your father, and we're going to do that fast. And we did that. And I went to Las Vegas where my father lived, and it was right around Thanksgiving. And I made an amends to my father, and it was my father and I had not been close, and we'd had a pretty troubled relationship. And he was so grateful that I had done that, and I was so grateful that we had this just incredible time. And my dad was not a person that talked about his emotions, and he told me that. He said, if anything ever happened to you, Tom, I don't know what I'd do. And I didn't think that was going to happen. And it was profound. And what I didn't know was going to happen is that the morning we got up to fly back here to Seattle, he woke up with pain in his chest. And this is November, it's at Thanksgiving, and we went back to Seattle. And within the next 2 months, my dad was diagnosed with terminal cancer, lung. It had metastasized into his everything, basically his spine and his lymph nodes. He was just riddled with cancer. And so I went to Paul, my sponsor, and I said, you know, my dad's going to die, and I need to go back to Las Vegas and be there. And he said, okay, so your job is to be of service. That's what you get to do. And that's what I did. I went to Las Vegas, and I gave people rides if they needed rides, and I stayed at the hospice with my dad, and I watched him die. And I was there when he died. There's so many miracles that have happened in this program, but the fact that, you know, I had met Paul, he'd said, let's do this thing with your father. I'd done it. And then, you know, this was November. He died January 2nd of that year. So it was 2 months later. It was amazing. It was an amazing experience. We buried him, and then I came back to Seattle, and I said, I'm in. Like, what happened there in terms of me getting right with my dad and then knowing how to show up at this event, let's do the rest. Let's do the steps. I'm ready, you know. And so I did. I leaned in, and we did the steps. What's happened since then, you know, I want to definitely talk about what's happening now. It's just been, just like the alcohol was a progression that got just worse and worse and worse. My sobriety experience, my recovery experience is that life has gotten better and better. And it's not perfect, and I wouldn't, you know, anyone says that any life is perfect. I don't know how that exists, but it's gotten better. And I've had to make big decisions in sobriety and recovery. You know, I had to decide whether or not I'd stay with that marriage. You know, and I didn't. And what we realized with the marriage is that we both got sober, and we kind of looked at each other and it was like, who are you? You know, because we were completely different people, and what we'd done. Basically, all the time we were together, is we drank. We didn't know what to do when we weren't drinking and doing drugs. We didn't really know. But the thing is, we did it. I did it. We did it with a lot of thought, and we did it. We went in therapy. We worked together for a long time. We tried. I finally realized at some point, I could try to stay with this relationship, and it would be a lot of work the rest of my life, and I just wasn't going to do that. I mean, I made that decision. I'm just not going to do that. I don't need to do that. And that was partly. It was partly something I'd learned in Al-Anon, probably, but I left the relationship, and I had to make decisions about whether to take jobs or not, and whether to move out of the way, and every one of those decisions since then, since I've been sober, I've made with my sponsor, I've gotten input from other people, and I've prayed about it, I've meditated about it, and it just, when I think about what's different today, I think about making that decision to move away to Astoria over a couple pitchers of beer, you know, and not getting any input from anybody that had any kind of influence that would have been a good, you know, source of information, and just going. And that move had tragic consequences for me. It was bad. Like it was a lot of things. I haven't talked about it all my whole story, but while all this else was going on, before I met my wife, I got a woman pregnant and have a child, right? And I didn't leave that out because it's not important, because it really is. But moving away from Nevada meant that I had been really involved in my child's life, and I wasn't anymore. That was one of the big consequences of that. What I've realized over the years and working through my recovery is that me going and beating myself up for the next 20 years about the fact that I moved away from my daughter doesn't help her. So what I've done since I've gotten recovery is I've been available to her, and we have a relationship, and I've been financially available for her. I've been, we see each other as often as we can. We've taken trips together, and we've got a really good relationship today. We've got a great relationship. But that was one of the things. So the difference in terms of decisions that I made pre and post recovery is profound. and that's one of the big things. You know, so and so I kept working. My sponsor, I got into a really a real good routine of prayer and meditation. It's been a practice that I've done for many years. I pray and meditate every morning, and I find that I'll miss a morning here and there, but mostly I do it, and I found that that's been a real benefit to my recovery. It's a difference between a day when I feel like I'm just, you know, I can pause before I say the thing I don't want to say and send the email I don't want to send, and when I do. And the prayer and meditation has been a big part of that. I still have a sponsor. I sponsor people. I go to meetings. I do service positions when I can. I always have a home group. You know, the stuff you're supposed to do. The other thing that it's interesting, you know, in the Al-Anon, this is an AA story, but I do have to weave a little bit Al-Anon back in. So about 10 years into recovery, you know, I'm feeling pretty good about things. I've worked the steps. I've got, you know, my job's good. My finances have kind of straightened out. I'm healthy. All things are good. And I get in this relationship. She's pretty, you know, and she's really dynamic, and also probably an alcoholic, you know. I mean, it's one of those things that I really didn't want to pay attention to, but she drank every night, and, you know, and so it's interesting. So what I found, and I wasn't even conscious of it really, is it was a relationship I really wanted to work out, and she was pretty hard to be in a relationship with, so I just kept trying to work on myself. That's what I've learned how to do. You know, that's one of the things I've done. I can fix this. So I just tried, and I really wasn't quite paying attention to. I don't know. I wasn't paying attention to really what was going on with me, because the way this relationship manifested itself was that she would do things like she would smoke pot because she got migraines. You know. And I wasn't judging smoking pot. I can't judge anybody for doing drugs or alcohol. Like, I'd be really hypocritical. Right? I've done enough, right? When people ask me, oh, you don't drink anymore? I said, yeah, I've had plenty. Like, it's not like I didn't get to have some, you know? But the thing is, when she smoked pot, she got really manipulative. She got really weird. She'd bring up, like, these ex-boyfriend. Oh, she'd go, like, you know, I'm thinking my ex-boyfriend wants to stay in my house next week. How would you feel about that? And it'd be, and I'd be like, I don't think that's a great idea. You know, I don't like that at all. And then I'd ask her, why? And are you doing that just to, like, I tell her, I'm crazy about you. You don't need to, like, make me feel jealous. I really like you. Like, you don't need to do this. And I don't think she was even doing it consciously. I think she's just one of these people that was just doing her thing. But it affected me in a pretty big way. And I didn't even realize what was going on. I've been wearing these rings for many years. I just like them, right? And I'm standing in a bathroom in my apartment, and they both go chink, chink. They fall off at the same time, which has never happened. I've been wearing these things for 20 years, right? And I'm scheduled to go to the doctor for a checkup, and I go to the doctor, and the doctor says, what's up with the weight? And I said, I don't know, what do you mean? He says, well, you're 30 pounds less than you were last year when you came in for your physical. And I had not really known that. Now, what I did know is that because of this anxiety I was feeling because of this relationship, I wasn't sleeping, and I wasn't eating because I wasn't hungry. I was working out like a fiend because I had all this energy because I couldn't sleep, but I had a lot of anxiety. So that the combination of working out really hard, not eating, not sleeping. By the way, if you want a diet plan, I mean, it works. You get in a really shitty relationship, but I wouldn't recommend it. I just thought that. Because, like, one of my friends is here, he said, yeah, you know, Tom's looking pretty good. And at one point he says, you know, Tom's not looking so good. Like, it just turned the corner in terms of, I don't know. But so the reason I mention that story is that I was after being in recovery for years, working the steps, and I kind of had that sense that I maybe had had it, you know, like, I got this again. And that's a dangerous place for me to be. I need to not think that. And so I got back in Al-Anon. I talked to my sponsor in AA, and And he's in Al-Anon too, and I asked him about him sponsoring me. He said, no, I think you should find another sponsor who's just an Al-Anon sponsor. And so I did. In fact, they're sitting next to each other here, and it's kind of freaking me out, because like I talk about not being able to bullshit anybody. How am I doing? All right? And between those two, wow. But it's been great because I've leaned back into the Al-Anon program, working the steps, I'm not in that relationship anymore. But I find, and it's been said, you know, many times this weekend, that Al-Anon helps me with everything in my life, every relationship I'm in. And not even if they're necessarily with alcoholics, it just helps me in my life and figuring out what my responsibility is and what other people's responsibility is. Thank you. And it's been profound. You know, and in my work it really helps. AA does well as well. You know, I have a home group in AA that I go to every week. I go to the Full Monty on Saturday. And it's 50 plus guys every Saturday. They get together and we get together and have coffee afterwards, and it's a foundation, one of the foundations of my recovery. And I'm honing in on an Al-Anon home group. I haven't been as good about finding, but I need to find one of those. But Al-Anon also helps me in terms of how I deal with others around me and the work I do. I work in a job where the people that work for me really don't work for me. They're volunteers. And so, I've managed lots of people, and even when you're managing people, you can't necessarily tell them what to do. They're still, you know, free thinking human beings. When you were in volunteers, you really have to approach them in a different way. I don't sign their paychecks, you know. But what I've learned from Al-Anon is really how to ask for what I need, and I do that a lot. Like, I need help with this project, and I need four or five of you to do this, and then just leave the outcome up to God. And I've learned how to do this through Al-Anon, and I'm leaning into Al-Anon more than I have, and it's been great. I'm working through the Blueprint for Progress right now, which is it's a lot, but it's really good. You know, it's really good to go through those questions, and I'm really getting a lot out of it. And so my program today is a combination of I didn't mention another program, but it just so happens that I'm also a member of the Sex Addicts Anonymous program. I'm not going to talk about that. This is an AA group. If you're curious about that, ask me about it. I'll tell you about it. But it's like there's that old Stuart Smalley thing where I'm a member of several self-help groups or whatever. I am, you know. But I need it, you know. It's not only need it, but I feel privileged to be able to have the opportunity to do it. And I feel very privileged to be able to have the opportunity to speak at this particular event. This retreat has been one of the cornerstones of my recovery. I look forward to it every year. I have, a group of friends that I come up with, and I also feel like I'm friends with everybody in this program. And it's interesting. You see this cross-section of people every year, and then you see new people every year. But it's one of those amazing events that it's kind of like, you know, organized anarchy the way it runs every year, you know. And I love that, you know. If you try to describe how this thing would work to somebody on the outside, they go, no way, right? You know, you got a what? You got a cat herder and a poobah, right? Which is just that in itself, you know, that we're not taking ourselves too seriously. Just I love that, right? But you know, it's great, and it's like a big spiritual dose of spirit, you know, spirit I get every year, and I really look forward to it. It's something that I hope I can continue to do for as long as this event is here. And the other things I guess I do now is I try to stay kind of in the herd, in the middle of the herd, and not get too far away from the program like you hear about. I still sponsor people. I haven't sponsored anybody in Al-Anon. I think it might be in my future, But I mean, it depends. If anyone wants to be sponsored by me, but I haven't raised my hand for it yet. But I hope so. I'd like to do that. But I sponsor somebody in AA right now. And I still approach things when I have an issue that comes up in my life and I have some sort of a decision to make, I still approach it through the 12 steps. I look at, you know, I read things about it. I talk to my sponsor. I talk to friends that I have in the program that I trust. And then I make a decision. And, you know, everything hasn't turned out in terms of these decisions the way I always thought it was going to turn out. But it's always been the right decision. Like when I look back at the decisions I've made in the last 15 years, they've been good decisions. No matter what happened, they've been solid decisions based upon, you know, the best information I can have and the most prayerful approach I can have to it. And that is just such a night and day difference between the kinds of decisions I made before that I'm just really I'm very, very grateful for that. I had another thing I was thinking about that was so funny about my family doesn't really understand this this recovery thing. They don't understand it. They're happy for me because they can tell I'm happier than I was. I was not a very happy guy. But it's so funny, and that's okay. They don't have to understand it, you know. My brother Joe, who loves me, he's 2 years older than me, and I love my brother, but when he found out that I was in AA and I was going to do AA, I told him, you know, I'm an alcoholic, I could do this thing. He said, "That's great, Tom." He says, "You're going to be the best." Right? Isn't that great? I said, "Joe, I don't think that's how it works." I'm not sure, but I don't think that's how it's going to be. But that's what I love about this program and all the programs is that I don't have to convince my brother or my anybody about it. I just got to keep showing up, and that's enough, you know. And it also allows me to have the kinds of relationships that I have now with family members, with people I work with my friends, that are just quality relationships. You know, these are really good relationships that are full of a lot of, you know, empathy and understanding and love and sometimes tough love. But we have real relationships. And that is one of the promises, right? That is really one of the, I don't know if it's spelled out that way, but that's one of the things I've seen that's a promise. And I did not think when I was in the midst of my addiction that I was going to have, I was going to be able to have authentic relationships like that. I just didn't think it was going to be for me. I'd kind of written those off. And, you know, I haven't found I haven't found another partner. I'm still single. I mean, I've had partners, but I don't have a partner right now. And, you know, I went through this thing last year where I really tried really hard to meet somebody, and I did the online dating. It's just exhausting, right? And then I realized at the end of the year, you know, what about just being okay? What about just, like, being okay, like, as you are, like yourself? And I kind of turned a corner on that. My friends are going to call bullshit on me because I was on Tinder, I think, last night. But I'm just dabbling in it. I'm just... I could put it away anytime. So I'm, you know, it's, I got, so I, I'm not done, right? But the thing is, I did. All kidding aside, I did come to this place at the end of the year where I realized I'm okay. You know, I'd love to meet somebody. I'd love to have another relationship, but I'm okay. And the reason I'm okay is I have, you know, you can get I've got intimate relationships from the men I know, and I've got good working relationships with people. I have, there's a lot of different ways to get love and to get connection in life, right? And I've found that through these programs. So I think I'm still have a little bit of time, but I'm actually going to end early if that's okay with everybody. I just want to say it's been a real honor to speak to you today and great retreat. Thanks.